Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Flourish FM. In this episode, Nick and I speak to Professor Amy C. Edmondson. She is the Novartis Professor of Leadership and Management at Harvard Business School, a chair established to support the study of human interactions that leads to the creation of successful enterprises that contribute to the betterment of society. She's pioneered the concept of psychological safety for over 20 years and was recognized in 2021 as number one on the Thinkers 50 global ranking of management thinkers. She's the author of several books, the most recent of which is Right Kind of Wrong, The Science of Failing Well, which is one of the key areas of our conversation today. Nick, what did you enjoy most about this conversation?
All of it. This was kind of one of those fanboy episodes for me a little bit. I have so much respect for her. I've done a lot of work around some of these ideas and tried to share them in some of my various capacities. She's really just tremendous. She's humble. She's easy to engage with. But she brought some, I thought, awesome nuances and insights. I think starting with what do we mean by psychological safety? You know, some of our listeners will hear that and jump to a conclusion. I think she does a great job right at the start of disrupting that. And then later, you know, kind of working through the nuances of how dealing with kind of risk-taking and unpleasantness and failing here and there is going to be like directly connected to our ability to succeed in the long term and thrive and things of that nature. So, but the entire conversation was just money. Anything stand out for you?
Many things. Like with you, I particularly enjoyed the interesting connection she drew throughout our conversation, and particularly later in the conversation, between psychological safety, intelligent failure, or like Right Kind of Wrong, title of the book, and thriving, not just collectively in organizations and teams, but also individually. And we discussed that as well later in the conversation. So we hope you enjoy this conversation as much as we did. This is our conversation with Amy Edmondson.
Okay, Amy, good morning. Thanks for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're really excited, I think, to jump into, I'd say it sounds like kind of two major categories of your work at this point. And obviously, we'll spend a great deal of the conversation focused on learning from failure and Right Kind of Wrong and some of the lessons that we can take from that. But we'd be remiss if we didn't spend a little time on psychological safety as well. And my guess is, and I want to dig into this in the questions, but my guess is there's probably a natural trajectory from one to the other, given your research and history and the things you're interested in and have contributed. So if we could start there, kind of real simple definition of psych safety, because I think there's some nuances we potentially want to tease out for an audience tuning into Flourishing. I want us to be real concrete about what we mean by psych safety, and then we'll take it from there.
So glad to do that, because with the sort of growth in popularity of psychological safety has also been a growth in misunderstandings of the term. And I define it as a belief that your environment is safe for interpersonal risk, like speaking up with ideas, questions, concerns, and even mistakes. And that also, that safety for risk also allows experimentation. So probably a simpler way to say that is it's a learning environment.
Well, that's perfect. And I wondered if you might, I'm so glad you include sort of that tolerance or environment for risk, because what I did not hear in your definition is an environment void of discomfort.
It's exactly the opposite, in fact. And this is where I think it's gotten most misunderstood. And I get it. The terminology can mislead. Safety, it sort of sounds comfortable. It's probably more accurate to call psychological safety an environment where you're comfortable being uncomfortable, like you expect to be uncomfortable, because work requires interpersonal risks to do it well. Teamwork requires interpersonal risks to do it well. And so psychological safety describes an environment where it's okay to be uncomfortable. It's going to come with the territory. And the reason why you're okay being uncomfortable is because you know that you won't experience just genuine rejection or humiliation or a sort of punishment by your peers or your managers. So it's a sense that not that it's easy to take these risks, but that they are valued, they're welcome. It's what we do around here.
Yeah. So for our listeners, can we illustrate a few different examples of this interpersonal risk? We're going to come on to the example of having the courage or feeling safe to admit where you think you may have failed. There's been a perceived failure, a mistake of some kind. Other types of failure might be you're at a networking event or a discussion of some kind and you feel safe in throwing out an idea, which is maybe quite a radical idea, which people will maybe disagree with, but you don't feel like you'll be judged really negatively for expressing it.
I think that's a very good example right there. I mean, I would start with, let's say I'm at work, maybe I'm a new employee, maybe I'm not, but I really don't know how to do something that I know I'm supposed to be able to do. Maybe it has to do with technology. Maybe it has to do with some nuance in the area of expertise that I'm supposed to have. And I feel absolutely able to ask for help. Right? I can ask a colleague. I can ask a manager. I don't know how to do this. Can you help me out? Right? And that's, and I'm not going to be overly concerned or embarrassed in making that request. So that would be an example of taking a risk at work that's going to help the quality of the work, of course. And it may even prevent a failure that could have otherwise happened. Another example would be just admitting a mistake. And you'd say, we'll come to that soon, but admitting a mistake in a timely way so that it can be kind of corrected before something worse happens.
I think that was the single just coolest insight from your TED Talk. And I think when I first started learning about your work, but kind of revealing that. And maybe you'd be willing to provide a kind of quick synopsis. You sort of gave the headline or the punchline there. But for our listeners, your TED Talk's been watched, I think, a couple million times at this point, right? Again, more willing to admit they made a mistake, right? Will you give a quick kind of summary of what you mentioned in the talk?
Right. So in the first TED Talk, which was a TEDx talk at Harvard Graduate School of Education, I described a study I had done where I measured the teamwork properties of a handful of hospital nursing teams, basically. And independently, medical researchers were assessing, gathering data on the error rates. And I understood that the way they were doing that was sort of going unit to unit, asking people, reviewing charts, and so forth. But like them, I believed that would be a reasonable way to measure error rates. Now, fast forward, I'm putting the data into my model. I'm correlating the teamwork properties with the error rates. And lo and behold, it's a significant correlation, but in the wrong direction. At first, I just panic. At first, it just feels like makes no sense. And it's truly a failure. It's a failure to support my hypothesis, as boring as the hypothesis was. And then I started to think more deeply about it. And it occurred to me that maybe, I didn't have the evidence yet, but maybe the better teams were more able and willing to speak up about mistakes. In other words, maybe what the dependent variable really was a reporting measure, not a measure of actual error rates, but of detected error rates. And maybe our ability to detect error rates varies based on something as soft as the interpersonal climate, which I later called psychological safety. And ultimately, in that study, but more in subsequent studies, I was able to show pretty conclusively that that's a good explanation, that there are these differences across teams in their comfort speaking up about sensitive issues and in their willingness to kind of not worry so much about self-protection, but be more focused on patient care, right? And just that honesty and that speed qualifies as better teamwork. It also qualifies as better professionalism, if you think about it. But it's not easy to do. It's not easy to do unless you have built an environment where people know this is what we do.
Well, that's my next question, right? It sounds like discomfort is potentially a part of that process, right? Or the experience, the phenomenon of psychological safety. Is it a prerequisite? Does there have to be vulnerability? Does there have to be repair? Can teams just kind of get to it without the peaks and valleys, just with the peaks?
I think it's probably not very often. I think we can get there quickly just by simply setting the stage. You know, okay, everybody, look at what's at stake. This is going to be the kind of place where we're going to have to speak up quickly and forcefully about what we notice, even when you're in doubt. This might be a problem, might not be a problem. But the default, right? I think if you do no work, no preparation, the default state is it will always be easier to hold back than to speak up. Right. So we think about the fundamental asymmetry here. If I am not quite sure, I think you might have made a mistake. Now, I can speak up or I can remain silent. If I speak up, who gains? Well, the team, maybe the patients, or it depends on what kind of work we do. But, you know, the organization, the collective stands to potentially gain. How confident am I that my speaking up will produce that gain? You know, not terribly, right? Because I'm not even sure I'm right. And I'm not sure you'll even listen to me, right? So my confidence isn't 100%. And when will that gain happen? Well, a little bit later. Now, what if I stay quiet? Who gains? Well, I do, right? And when? Immediately. I mean, I gain because I'm sort of safe and protected. Nothing bad happens to me. No one ever gets fired for silence. So that's a fundamental asymmetry, you know, where the reward for speaking up is delayed and uncertain, and the gain from silence is immediate and certain. So, of course, you know, people are going to err on the side of holding back. And so I think in order to create an environment where that's not the case, you have to do a little stage setting.
Makes a lot of sense. Explicit about the what, maybe even the how, kind of methods of interacting, those sorts of things.
Yeah. And say things like, the nature of the work we do requires us to be really candid and really quick. And it's not easy. It'll never be easy, but we're going to support each other in doing it, make it happen.
So let's assume a leader does some of that staging. Makes a lot of sense. When we talk about human flourishing, I think there's a lot of ways of defining it, but there's kind of two generally components. I think there's a performative and there's an affective. So how do we feel? How do we perform? How do we behave? Those sorts of things. We're talking a lot, I think, a bit about the affective, the feeling side. What do we tend to see as outcomes in psychologically safe teams once they've got that environment in place, right? How does that correlate with performance?
Well, that's the good news. It correlates very well with performance across industry settings. And in fact, I think this got the most attention in the aftermath of a famous study at Google called Project Aristotle, where they systematically looked at 180 teams or so and found that the best predictor of team performance was psychological safety, right? So that the teams, first of all, we learned from that study that psychological safety varied across teams, or it wouldn't be very predictive if everybody had the same level, and that it was a truly good predictor of psychological safety. But many studies in the academic literature show the same thing. In fact, a PhD student named Derek Bransby and I wrote a review about a year and a half ago of sort of the literature to date. And there's a robust relationship between psychological safety and performance. Now, why might be that case? Well, again, it's because so much of the work that needs to be done involves uncertainty and interdependence. And we got to coordinate with each other, and we got to catch and correct things that go wrong in a timely way. And all of that is interpersonally challenging. And so we need to kind of have that climate to do it well. Now, there was another great review paper by Stuart Bunderson at Washington University, where he and his student Brett Sanner showed that they just did a review of the literature to date, it was maybe a decade ago, and showed that, again, robust relationship between psychological safety and performance in teams, and the effect size, you know, the degree to which there is a correlation between psychological safety and performance goes up as the work is more knowledge intensive, requires creativity, ingenuity, judgment to do it well. So that I thought was a very elegant finding. If you have a very routine task, the relationship between psychological safety and performance is far lower than if you have a very sort of knowledge intensive task where our ability to share information with each other is that much more determinative of our performance.
Mm-hmm. That makes good sense. Yeah,
absolutely. And you distinguish between certain levels of psychological safety. Can you talk us through the different levels?
Well, you know, this is not really truly scientific. This is sort of observational, but there's at the very lowest level, we have an environment of fear, right? And a genuine sort of anxiety. You just, in fact, in one study I described, the experience of teams with low psychological safety would be described as, gosh, you know, if you make a mistake around here, you get put on trial. I was made to feel like a 2-year-old, right? That would be very, very low psychological safety. You know, at the highest level of psychological safety, it's a sort of a real willingness to lean in to risk and uncertainty, a kind of confident speaking up about concerns, questions. You even often will see that people aren't taking themselves too seriously. They're sort of much more focused on the work than on themselves, in a sense. In between, you know, there's often a kind of, well, there's no obvious problems around here, right? I mean, people seem to be respectful and polite, and it's hard for them to know, and it's hard for, I think, observers to know how far under their performance or appreciation of their environment they are, right? So no obvious problems, but there's real room to improve.
Don't know what they don't know, not necessarily right. Languishing, right. But not thriving either.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Not thriving. You know, it's like it's good enough.
Mm-hmm. I'm super curious. You've used the term lean in a couple of times. And over the last, I don't know, couple of years or so, I've become very interested in the term anti-fragile. And I'm curious, there's a little line of research that talks about the difference between what they call facilitative environments or unrelenting environments. You familiar with these terms or that research at all?
No, but they do sound.
That's why I'm raising. I'm curious to just get your reaction to it. Basically, you know, think of four quadrants. Your facilitative mm-hmm. environment is high challenge and high support.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yes. Unrelenting, yes. High challenge, very low support.
Oh, that's exactly right.
Interesting.
Bob Keegan at the Ed School has a chart like that. I think it's roughly those two dimensions, challenge and support. Okay. And okay. Kinsey also uses that 2x2. And with them, I did a study with them where we showed in that upper right-hand quadrant that psychological safety, obviously, was the highest. The learning behaviors were the highest. It was essentially better leadership. But I had long used a 2x2 that is psychological safety as the vertical axis, right? High, low. Okay. And okay. Then, you know, accountability as the horizontal axis.
Interesting.
And one way to think about it is the vertical axis is the interpersonal environment. You know, is it safe or is it kind of a tiptoe kind of place? And the horizontal axis is the performance environment. Is this a place where we believe we are expected to hit high standards, where there's a kind of a genuine desire to do that? I sometimes think of this as psychological ownership, you know, psychological safety and psychological ownership, but the performance environment. And we all know that what that feels like, you know, a performance environment where, yeah, we are here and to do our best. We want to do our best. We want to support each other in doing our best versus a kind of lackadaisical one. Now, exactly as you just described, the lower right-hand quadrant, I call it the anxiety zone or the interpersonal anxiety zone. You know, this is where people are motivated and they also believe there are consequences of performance and they're afraid to ask for help when they're in over their head or they're afraid to disagree with the boss, right? And that, I, depending on the industry, depending on the context, can be, you know, a truly problematic and even dangerous work environment. You know, dangerous if there's human safety involved, even, you know, worker safety, and you can't tell someone, you know, put on your safety goggles or whatever it is, because we don't do that. So yes, right. And I'm always saying we got to get into that upper right, which is high challenge, high support, or high psychological safety and high performance standards.
It makes me think, I'm curious in your work, have you found, I'm not trying to put you on the spot here, but particular industries that struggle with this maybe more than others? Because I work with a lot of first responders. My head went straight to there, especially in the policing community, just an unwillingness to speak up to one another in many cases in some cases, legitimate reasons and real social pressures. But just curious if you've kind of seen, you know, some differences among industry.
There's enough within industry variance compared to between industry variance that it's hard to really draw conclusions. But I do think, like in many police departments and first responder environments, there's a kind of culture of toughness and culture of we're supposed to be able to solve our own problems and do everything. And that can, and it can be seen as weakness, say, to ask for help. And it can be seen as an affront to tell someone they're doing it wrong, right? Because of the culture that's been established around what a good professional around here is like. And that can be quite at odds with the learning environment. When I think about that question of industries where this is present, I think of the high reliability organization research, which essentially answers the question of how is it that so many routinely dangerous environments, operations, manage to operate safely essentially all the time, right? What's going on there? And, you know, whether that's nuclear power or aircraft carriers or air traffic control. And what's going on there is a real attention to creating the kind of culture where people just don't hesitate to speak up. People interact with each other in a very thoughtful, heedful way. They're paying attention, they're mindful, and they're not at all blind to the possibility of failure and mistakes. They're ever aware of the possibility of mistakes and failures. And so because of that sort of heightened awareness, they have a heightened mindfulness in their interactions.
So this leads us very nicely then into your most recent book, Right Kind of Wrong, Why Learning to Fail Can Teach Us to Thrive. So you draw very clear connections in the book between psychological safety and Right Kind of Wrong. But did your interest in this, in types of failure or perceived failure and distinctions amongst types, which we'll get into, such as mistakes and errors and so on, did that emerge from your research in psychological safety? Because there's a natural transition from one to the other.
It's almost the other way around. Mm. But the truth is it's all one. I mean, it's all of a piece. It's all how do we make sense of and indeed thrive in our uncertain, challenging world. That's hard. We're not easily made comfortable with that goal, right? It's just it requires us to swim upstream. So I had initially and long been interested in the idea of the learning organization, right? How do organizations keep learning, innovating, adapting, improving as they must to thrive in a changing world, right? That just seemed like an interesting problem to me. And if you go into organizations, as I had, you know, a lot, you see more barriers to being a learning organization than enablers to being a learning organization. And one of the things that is part of this equation is the ability of organizations to learn from their mistakes and failures. And turns out, as everybody probably already knew, that's not easy. First and foremost, because if we're not speaking up about them, we're not learning. Like, I might learn from my mistake, but if I don't tell you about it, you don't learn. And then you're either doomed to repeat it in some other context where you could have prevented it if I had helped you learn with my experience or some other problem. So as I became more and more interested in this problem of organizations and teams needing to learn, then I started realizing you need to create the environment where this kind of candor is possible for the organization to learn. So I guess I was interested in failure before I stumbled into the idea of psychological safety. And then it was always lurking in the background. And whenever I was in organizations, either as a researcher or a consultant, I would find that people still had confusion, right, about, say, the difference between good failures and bad failures. Like, they still had a sense of embarrassment about all of it. Even in an environment where you're literally trying to innovate, so you're trying to experiment and you don't get the result you want, people still felt sort of embarrassed by it rather than, yeah, this is part of the game.
Hi, friends. Nick here with just a brief interlude to share with you an update on one of our newest partnerships with the Anti-Fragile Academy. Throughout John and I's conversations with many, if not most, of our guests, one thing has been made really clear. In order for people to flourish, thrive, experience the good life, they need to develop the capacity to not only navigate and endure, but ideally grow from the bad, grow from unpleasant experiences. That's why we're thrilled to be partnering with our newest sponsor, the Anti-Fragile Academy, an organization that I co-founded with Dr. Adam Wright, Director of Mental Performance for the Washington Nationals. At the Anti-Fragile Academy, we work with adolescent athletes, executives, and educators to help them understand some of the science, not just of optimal performance, but of well-being and anti-fragility. The ability not only to endure and bounce back from unpleasantness, but to actually come back stronger, to grow from it. Between Adam and I, we've worked with Fortune 100 companies, Inc. 300 executives, Division I programs, and elite professional athletes and Olympians from all over the world. To find out more about how you can leverage anti-fragility training, check out our website at theantifragileacademy.com. Do you think that there's probably some level of like germane affect in that, right? Like guilt or like, I mean, my initial reaction is, well, maybe we should on some level if there was a real mistake. It's just the distinction. But it's just the distinction that they can still put that out there and admit it and learn from it.
Well, in fact, here's an illustration of what I mean, which is many people will use the term mistake and failure interchangeably, right? So there'll be a kind of an experiment that fails, right? That yields a failure, not a success, but it was in new territory where there really was no way to know in advance what would happen. You had to try it. And people will call it a mistake, but it's not a mistake, right? A mistake is when we had the knowledge and we didn't use it. We deviated from it. I put sugar where I was supposed to put, you know, flour in the recipe or salt, whatever. And that's a mistake. But trying out some hypothesized new recipe that doesn't end up being very delicious, that's not a mistake. That's a failure. So failure is a broader term, right? Failure encompasses things caused by error and things caused by, ooh, the world doesn't work the way we thought it might.
Yeah. So let's tease apart some of these differences because you just distinguish between types of failure, right? You distinguish between good and bad failures.
Mm-hmm,
then
mm-hmm.
There's three failure archetypes: intelligent, basic, and complex failures.
Yes.
There's errors, mistakes, and violations. And then there's failures that are the right kind of wrong.
Right. Absolutely.
So can you please describe these distinctions?
So the one thing I'll say right off the bat is I think of errors and mistakes as synonymous. Errors is maybe a more academic word, but a mistake more of a colloquial word, but they both refer to deviations from a known practice or protocol. And we're doing something wrong that we could have done right because there was knowledge for doing it. A violation is a deliberate deviation from a known practice, right? I'm doing it on purpose to cause harm because I don't feel like doing it right. And so that's a mistake is always unintentional. It's not because otherwise it would be a violation or an experiment. But when I make a mistake, which I do routinely, I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to make that mistake. That's mistakes and violations and errors. Now, the three archetypes of failure that I have sort of discovered that things really fall nicely into these categories over many years of looking at things that go wrong are basic failures, which are single cause failures and generally human error. There was knowledge about how to get the result we want, but we made a mistake and left the kid in the taxi. I don't know. That's one story in the book. And those are bad, right? In fact, I have a whole chapter devoted to the best practices that we know that have been sort of accumulated by many, many people over many, many decades for organizations and people in our lives preventing basic failures, right? When we really are mindful, when we use checklists, when we pay attention to the knowledge we have, ask people for help when we're in over our head, et cetera, we can do a pretty darn good job of preventing the basic failures in our organizations. The complex failures are multi-causal. They are the perfect storms. They're the failures that are caused by a handful of factors coming together in just the wrong way, where any one of those factors on its own would not have led to the failure. It's the combination. And they're numerous in our lives. And they happen because sometimes it's just we're maybe not doing the very best job we can, and we encounter some really bad luck, that a traffic jam that couldn't have been predicted because of a tractor trailer crash. And that adds on to all the other bits of the situation to end up putting us, you know, into a complex failure. One of the things about complex failures is you do have the Monday morning quarterback opportunity. Mm. sort of to second guess them. But many catastrophic accidents and environmental spills and so on in history, recent and not so recent, qualify as complex failures. It's not sort of one person doing one stupid thing that leads to them. It's a handful of factors coming together and leading to a sort of problematic failure. And again, these aren't the good kind, obviously. And when we are at our best, we can prevent most of them. Right? And it's often the best prevention strategy is the timely speaking up. So again, you see where psychological safety shows up.
Sorry, Karen.
So many of the basic failures I've studied and write about in the book are ones where had someone, you know, and there were people who had worries, had those individuals spoken up in a timely way, there was every chance of preventing the ultimate failure. And then intelligent failures. And these are the good kind, right? These are the kind that we have to learn to love. And these are undesired results of thoughtful forays in new territory. So the criteria that I identify, first, it has to be new territory. You can't just look up the solution on the internet, right? We don't know yet. You are in pursuit of a goal. You see some reason why this risk is worth taking. You've done your homework. You have a hypothesis. There's good reason to believe this might work. And then finally, probably most importantly, it's no bigger. The failure is no bigger than it has to be to get the new knowledge. And so in a scientific laboratory, they are experiencing intelligent failures all day long, right? It's part and parcel of the work they do. There are the people whose job it is to go into new territory and try to figure out the answers to questions we don't yet know. And because that's their job, they will often have to experience failure if they're on the leading edge of, you know, of any field. But people in innovation departments and companies also should be experiencing a healthy portion of failures, or they're not really innovating. You know,
you're not on the edge.
They're not on the edge, right? So that, and if you're an innovator, you want to be an innovator. In order to be flourishing, you're going to also have to be failing. And that sounds like, okay, well, then it's fun for them. Well, it isn't. It turns out they don't like failing either, right? But they understand, they do it because they understand it's actually part of the job description.
Mm. If you are an innovator, a creator, to be flourishing, you have to be failing.
So yeah, we've got the connection, it seems, then, in your work between psychological safety, intelligent failure, failing the right way, right kind of wrong, and flourishing or thriving. The idea is that in order to fail well, to promote the possibility of intelligent failure and reduce the likelihood of errors, mistakes, and certainly violations, you need to create a psychologically safe environment. And that also helps organizations and businesses thrive. And by promoting that environment and promoting the likelihood of intelligent failure, businesses can thrive even more.
Exactly. You know, and in fact, I mean, I love the word thriving, and the title of the last chapter of the book is Thriving as a Fallible Human Being. You know, and I love that juxtaposition, right? Because we are all fallible human beings. And yet that should not, must not stop us from thriving. But in order to really thrive, despite our fallibility, we have to be okay with our fallibility. We have to know, yep, I'm going to make mistakes now and then. I'm going to also have intelligent failures in new territory. But that's part of a sort of a full and adventurous life.
I'm really interested how this manifests in what I'm going to loosely call really high performing environments and really high performing teams. My general experience with those individuals is they are often perfectionists, sometimes maladaptive to a point. And I'm just curious, you know, how a phenomenon like perfectionism interacts with an idea like cultivating psychological safety.
It interacts very well indeed. I mean, perfectionism is, I think, the enemy of thriving, because it's basically saying, oh, no, I can't be a fallible human being. I have to be a perfect human being. I have to do everything perfectly, which, first of all, isn't possible. And then second of all, is going to naturally lead you to hide, you know, to hide your imperfections, to and then to absolutely scale back your ambitions, right? Because you're going to want to only do the kinds of things that you know you can do well, which limits your scope. And so it sort of, you know, it makes your experience smaller and I think lonelier, because how do we really connect with another human being if we can't sort of be vulnerable and can't be upfront about our anxieties and weaknesses and concerns?
So does this mean that psychological safety can extend beyond just interpersonal environments? Because it was defined in that way to start, right? I'm imagining now the solopreneur, the person who works entirely for themselves, having to overcome certain perfectionist tendencies, but also create the kind of own psychologically safe environment where they're like, they can say to themselves, you know, you screwed up here, you made a mistake, but you should, you know, admit that to yourself, admit that maybe you have a weakness here and you need to overcome that. The weakness may be perfectionism, let's say, in order to avoid this happening again.
Yes. You know, I have defined the construct and measured it as an interpersonal environment. And there are some individual differences, which I've studied less frequently, but individual differences in people's propensity to be comfortable with that kind of environment, right? And one of the, you know, the big five, the so-called big five in psychological research, people think when they learn about psychological safety, they often first think about introversion, extroversion. Well, this is about you're being an extrovert. Not really. Actually, there's no statistical difference in terms of your likelihood of experiencing psychological safety at work based on whether you're an introvert or an extrovert. That really describes how much energy it takes from you to interact meaningfully, but it doesn't describe how afraid or anxious you are about what you might say, about the content of what you might say. The one dimension that does have a significant correlation is neuroticism. Right? So people who are high on neuroticism tend to have lower psychological safety. And I don't know for sure, but it seems like there might be a relationship between neuroticism and perfectionism. They seem to have some attributes in common. But neuroticism really has to do with that sense that, you know, I think others are judging you and others are, I don't know, that like things will go wrong.
I was curious about openness. I thought you would say openness, actually, when you mentioned neuroticism, but on the positive side, because you described the way you were talking about it before, I thought about like Dweck stuff and fixed mindset and optimism and taking chances. And that all sounds, you know, I would have not been surprised if you had mentioned a correlation. Yeah.
Openness has a correlation too. You're absolutely right. And it's a lower one, but it's still significant.
Okay. Significant. Okay.
And it makes sense.
So we talk, so you mentioned science earlier as an example of where there's a lot of intelligent failure, because and we could maybe apply that to research more broadly, because there you're making progress in terms of discoveries and moving forwards with the discovery of knowledge and making original contributions to knowledge and so on. Mm-hmm. And we've just talked there about how maybe there's a type of psychological safety or application of certain ideas from it in just the single person, as it were, in their own life when they're not, as it were, working a team. In the book, you also describe kind of examples from people's personal lives. So there's the example you give of the woman who's trying to find a romantic partner and has what perhaps could be described as intelligent failure in the book. The man who awfully orders all this stuff off the menu and then just leaves the table. He says he's going to the toilet and then just...
Terrible, right? Unconscionable. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's an intelligent failure, right? Because certainly Amy Webb would have had no reason to imagine that would happen. That's just sort of not a reasonable thing to do. And for her, it was a new foray into the dating app territory, right? She'd never tried it before. It's a good hypothesis that you should be able to do that, have a date, and it may be great, it may not be great, but you'd rarely imagine that the date was going to order everything off the menu and then say he was going to the men's room and then disappear, right? That's sort of a little hard to have predicted that one. Definitely a failure and definitely intelligent. But what she did with that disappointing, you know, experience was not, okay, I'm never doing this again, but rather go back and figure out, okay, how do I actually present myself to meet the kind of person I really want to meet and have a a success as a result of this tool and this technology. And there's quite a bit of detail about how she sort of reverse engineered, learned how to reverse engineer the kind of profile that was accurate, but just, you know, that we're all complex human beings, right? Which part of myself should I be describing? Which part of myself is less relevant, less useful? And she was able to turn that intelligent failure into subsequent remarkable success.
Yeah. So, yeah, the broader theme here then is how we kind of apply your insights from right kind of wrong in our personal lives as well as our professional lives. So let's kind of get into some practical steps that listeners can take away. So what are some key steps you recommend people take, or some maybe other examples that we can then extract key steps from about how to apply the science of failing well into not just our professional lives with teams for innovation, but also in our personal day-to-day experiences?
Well, I think first we all have to routinely just accept the fact of our fallibility, right? We will make mistakes. And so that's sort of job one. And then I think the next thing is the sort of paradoxical advice to fail more often. And I don't mean go out and deliberately screw things up. That would be violation. But take risks, right? Be willing to start a new hobby that you've long been interested in, but worry you won't be good at. Like a friend recently picked up, you know, pottery. It turns out to not be easy to make beautiful things, but there's a certain joy in getting better at it. But for sure, those initial efforts at making some beautiful vase are a failure. So fail more often, right? Be willing. Let yourself experience the temporary pain of failure rather than the enduring pain of regret for not trying. Certainly, we've already talked about perfectionism, but coach yourself into resisting the tendency to fall into even any, you know, any degree of perfectionism. You know, learn to celebrate the pivots in your life, right? To not everything you try, especially in new territory, will work out as you had hoped. It's okay to then shift directions, try something else. Certainly dating, you know, the search for a life partner for most people involves some pivots along the way. And that ultimately is you know, it often has a happy ending, or, you know, happy beginning that follows it. I do think persistence and adopting the growth mindset, for sure, the mindset to force yourself to believe, because it's true, that when you stretch and try and you learn and grow, you get better at the things that you've put in your path. So that requires some grit, some persistence. And maybe I'll just add the building in habit of reflection, of more systematic reflection than most of us typically do. Don't just hurry on when something doesn't go the way you wanted it to. Okay, I'll just try it better next time. But pause to say, or carve out a little time to think through what happened, what your contribution to the failure might have been, what you might try next time. So thinking more deeply about, more analytically and deeply about what happened, so as to really gain the lessons from it.
I'm curious. I want to ask a similar question, but kind of on the negative end and the professional side, like things to avoid, because it seems to me the sort of phenomenon that likely behaves like trust, the whole gain it in drops, lose it in buckets. Like, what are the bucket dumping behaviors that a leader might do to really put his team in a tough spot to recover from, his or her team, excuse me?
Well, I mean, I think this is obvious, but an overly fast and negative emotional reaction to a disappointment, you know, failure, it's so human, almost an instinct, you know, to get angry, to say something like, how the heck did that happen? You know, rather than breathe and then say, thank you so much for bringing it to my attention, right? And then what next, right? So there's, I think our instinctive reaction to failures as leaders is generally not productive and can create, as you say, a long shadow that is hard to dig back out of. That's a mixed metaphor for sure. So it's, you know, it's really important. I think part leadership is hard, right? Leadership is, I think leadership is all about resisting the impulse and instead taking the moment to think, what would be helpful here? Because it's, oh, leadership is always about the future. It's always about what do I need to do now so that we can be flourishing in the future, so that we can have excellent performance and affect in the future. And most of the time, your instincts, especially in the aftermath of something going wrong, will not be helpful.
Really sounds like there's an undercurrent of a required mindful awareness and attention.
Yes. Yes. Internalizing the idea that leadership is about others, about the future, right? So you're oriented, you're always oriented to, I think, toward that service of the collective. You're trying to serve the collective, whether that's customers or patients or the team, but it's not about you.
Mm-hmm. So we want to also want to think about here what would be an example of a good and a bad culture in relation to these questions. In Silicon Valley, failure is, you know, really celebrated, right? Like fail.
Yeah, at least they like to think so.
Right? So you criticize this in the book, right, as not a good example.
I do not criticize the sort of the celebration of intelligent failures. What I criticize is the lack of specificity. You know, the idea that failure parties, fail fast, fail often. I think they intuitively understand that that is for new territory, not for sort of doing stupid things that were easy to predict in advance would fail if you took 5 minutes to do your homework. But the rhetoric is often unspecific or not nuanced. And to me, context is everything. In fact, if there's one thing I really want people to take away from the book is first, size up the context. You know, where are you? And how, and that fundamentally, that's what are the stakes, both economic, reputational, human safety, high, low, and how much uncertainty is there, right? Is this really known territory? Let's roll up our sleeves and do what we know how to do beautifully, vigilantly. Or is this kind of, gosh, no one's ever been here before. What can we learn and how quickly can we learn it? And I think in the rhetoric, the fail fast, fail often rhetoric, that's understood to mean, say, a startup company or a brand new product or project that could be a real breakthrough if we're right. If we're wrong, it's better to figure that out quickly so we can pivot and try something else. So I'm a big fan of that mindset, but I worry that a person just hearing it is going to go, yeah, wait a minute. Not in the real world, not where I work. I mean, this whole fail fast, celebrate failure thing, that doesn't apply over here. And they're probably right. It doesn't apply everywhere. It applies to some contexts and not others. And particularly where, you know, the stakes are reasonably manageable, whether economically, reputationally, and, you know, the uncertainty is relatively high. Then we have no choice but to be willing to experiment, to take the risk that we might be right, but we might be wrong.
You really highlight an important piece there because we talk a lot about mindsets. We've had a lot of guests on about mindsets. We do a lot of work around mindsets. I'll always contend there's not a mindset that's just sort of right for every context, right? Which is exactly what you're highlighting. I always use the kind of hyperbolic example of if I want to, you know, go have a pint with John in London, I shouldn't have a growth mindset that I can swim there. Sort of deal, right? Like, I mean, and it's, you know, it's a bit much, but like, to me, that's what you're getting at is if your mindset is move fast and break things, well, that doesn't make sense in a highly dangerous, regulated sort of industry, right? You've got to apply these things where it makes sense.
Yeah. And do not move fast and break things in a nuclear power plant.
Right.
You know, catastrophic. Yeah. And also, you know, this swimming to London thing, you know, brings up the idea of monitoring the challenge, right? You can't, you can't swim to London before you can like swim across your local pond, and you have to, can't swim to London at all. I venture to say, but you have to sort of be thoughtful. And again, that's the size thing. You have to be thoughtful about the size of the experiment or risk you should take. You know, how no bigger than necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like the example you gave in the book of a good strategy. Astro Teller, head of X Alphabet, who gives failure bonuses to employees who admit a project isn't working.
In a timely way, right? Because that's money in the bank. One of the human tendencies when something is not working is to push harder, right? Or almost it can be a form of denial too. Like, well, maybe it'll work out. Maybe next month it'll look different than this month. No, it won't. Once you have figured out this is not working, the sooner you can say so and then redirect those valuable resources, people and otherwise, to some other risky project, the better off you are. And recognizing that, you really do have to reward those who will stand up and say, this is failing. And you might think, well, then wouldn't everybody just want to stand up and say it's failing? No, of course not. Because people really do want to succeed, right? They want their wild new ideas to be great and to end up being the winner. They don't want to fail. So the incentive is still there to do great things, but you've got to overcome the natural incentive to just push it along and hide and say, mm-hmm. maybe mm-hmm. it'll work next month.
Okay. All right, Amy, we have one more question. What is one lesson on flourishing you want our listeners to walk away with? And what's a practical step for putting that into action?
Take more risks. You know, as Eleanor Roosevelt once said, do one thing every day that scares you. Maybe it doesn't have to be every day, but at least every week. And I think the practical advice for putting it into action is found in chapter 5, where I describe a process that I learned from a former mentor, Larry Wilson, which is stop, challenge, choose. And this is how I think we manage. It's a strategy for managing affect, the negative affect, right? When things don't go the way we had hoped, we immediately feel pain, embarrassment, some kind of negative emotion. That is the moment where we can learn, we can train ourselves to pause, breathe, challenge the thinking, right? Challenge the thinking that itself is producing the negative emotion and choose a more productive thought pattern that says, okay, let's pivot, or whatever. You know, whatever the situation is. So take more risks and then learn to stop, challenge the unhelpful thinking, and choose more healthy thinking for thriving.
Excellent. Love that. Great. Amy, we'll start to wrap here. You've got so much good work, so many great resources. Where should people go to find out more about you, interact with you? The book is The Right Kind of Wrong. I'm sure you can get it anywhere, but how can they engage with you further?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on what used to be called Twitter still. For how much longer, I don't know. And I have a website, Amy C. Edmondson, that is also got lists of, you know, articles and various other links.
Yeah. Lots of resources there. Great. We'll throw it all in the show notes, obviously. But thank you again so much for the time and the conversation today. This was a lot of fun and a real big honor for John and I. So we're deeply appreciative.
Not at all. I'm deeply appreciative of the work you're doing, truly.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for listening to Flourish FM. We hope you enjoyed the content. Please be sure to leave us a 5-star review and hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to your podcast and on all major social media platforms.
And if you visit our website, flourishfmpodcast.com, you can sign up to our newsletter. We send out a weekly newsletter, first newsletter of every month. We share a long form blog, and every newsletter every week we share highlights from our previous episodes. Please hit subscribe on our website.